We're previewing Wild Card Weekend, why the Eagles actually match up pretty well with the Bears. Will Phillip Rivers put up another dud against the Ravens? A couple of very similar teams battle Saturday night in Cowboys-Seahawks. And will the Colts just throw it all over the place in Houston on Saturday? Plus, Todd Gurley's value to the Rams. It's all on the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. Wild Card Weekend is almost upon us. We are going to be breaking down those four games, plus a little bit of a coaching carousel talk here with a couple names that surprised us, Andy. We didn't think when we were taping the Monday show they were going to be gone.
No, I don't think it was shocking once we heard they were. You're talking Adam Gase and Marvin Lewis.
Adam Gase and Marvin Lewis.
I don't think it was shocking because we'd heard maybe they might be, maybe they won't be. But yeah, it's we'll talk about it later on. There are 8 head coaching positions open, and there are 4 playoff games. This is the best time of year for podcasting and sports talk radio and all that pontificating.
This podcast specifically, though. All right, so we're going to break down the 4 games here, the 4 wild card games. We are going to, if you're someone who likes to jump around, maybe you're a Seahawks fan and you only want to hear what we say about the Seahawks, we are doing it in reverse order of how the games will be played. So we are starting with Bears-Eagles, then Chargers-Ravens, then the Saturday night game, Cowboys-Seahawks, and then the Colts-Texans is fourth, because that's just how we are going to do it. I don't have a real explanation for you. So
There is an explanation. It's my genius idea legacy, you said. We do it this way so the show stays fresh through Saturday night. So if you want to listen Sunday morning, we still have games you haven't seen up front. It's a very good organization.
That is true. And I did tell Andy it would be his legacy for future generations. This is what they would talk about as far as his contribution to society goes.
Uh-huh.
Good work, Andy.
Well, good. Thank you for dismissing it right as we start recording.
I was just going to gloss over the whole thing. But if you want credit on it, I'll give you the credit. It was your idea. Let's talk about Bears-Eagles here. And let's start with it. We're going to do both sides of the ball for all these games here. But let's start with Eagles offense versus Bears defense. And I don't want to overstate this because no one, you know, you don't feel good about anyone going up against this Bears defense. They're so talented. But you like the schematic matchup here with the Eagles offense against the Bears defense.
I'm extremely intrigued by it because Philadelphia, the more I watch them, I just got done watching their Redskins game here this morning, and they killed the Redskins by flooding their linebackers in zone coverage. So if I'm Mason Foster, Washington's linebacker, I constantly had 2 receivers running in front of me and 1 running behind me, and I had to figure out how to play zone against that, and there's no right answer. That's the problem with it. The Eagles do that better than any team, and they do it inside, like against Washington, and they do it outside depending on the opponent and who they're facing. So big picture of Philadelphia, they're so good because they out-leverage your zone coverage with their route combinations. Big picture on Chicago, they're 12-4 because they're the best zone defense in the NFL. So this is strength on strength. And what makes Chicago such a good zone defense is, and our listeners know this by now, they've heard us say this before, you're never quite sure what zone they're playing. Their safeties are blurry, their linebackers are blurry, their corners do a great job of matching up to patterns and then passing them off. So the zone coverages take on man-to-man elements in certain spots. It's a really hard zone defense to play against schematically. Plus, you got Khalil Mack coming at you, and it's a really good Eagles offense to attack zone coverage.
So 2 individual players, or 1 individual matchup and 1 individual player to talk about here. Khalil Mack, the Eagles have Lane Johnson. In theory, if you were going to pluck a right tackle from anywhere in the league and say, we think maybe you have a chance to survive one-on-one against Khalil Mack, it's probably Lane Johnson.
In theory, if we're talking a one-off, one game, I'm probably playing with Lane Johnson. Now, if we're talking 16 games, there are about 2 or 3 other right tackles I'd take because Lane Johnson is wildly inconsistent. And I was thinking about him or Mitchell Schwartz for the All-Pro vote the other night, and it was an easy call because Lane Johnson has, as for as many ups as he has a lot of downs. But his ups can come against the best guys. He outplayed J.J. Watt a few weeks ago, one-on-one most of the time. So to answer your question, yeah, Gary, that's who I do want is Lane Johnson against Khalil Mack. And if I'm the Eagles, I'm just keeping my fingers crossed that today we get the good Lane Johnson.
and Nick Foles. What's your feeling on Nick Foles this year? Because, you know, last year we saw him in the NFC title game and in the Super Bowl. He was a guy who was making great plays late in the down. You saw flashes of that, you know, especially the Houston game 2 weeks ago. Can he keep doing it? I mean, what's your gut feeling? I guess he can keep doing it because he has done it, and therefore he can continue to do it. Do you find it likely?
I don't think you can ever find something like that likely, even with the greatest. Like, let me ask you this, because the best I've seen is probably Andrew Luck at doing that, or certainly one of the best. Aaron Rodgers would be up there. But do you find it likely that Luck can do that, make plays late in the down against Houston this week? Find it likely.
Likely is probably not the word. Frequently
right.
enough to be the difference between you know, two touchdown drives and maybe a field goal drive and a punt drive. How's
yeah.
that?
It's all right. It's I don't think the Eagles can rely on, let's put it this way. If they have to get that from Foles as much as they got it last year against the Vikings in the championship and then against the Patriots in the Super Bowl, if they have to have it that many times, I don't think they'll win this game. So I do think, out of respect for what Foles has done, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Yeah, he can extend some plays. But what makes him at his best and why this offense has looked pretty good with him is he just, as we said, it's a well-designed offense, and he runs it exactly as it's designed. He's an on-schedule
yeah.
player at his best.
Yeah. All right, well, let's flip it around. Bears offense versus Eagles defense. You know, we've talked about this Matt Nagy offense all season, all the misdirection they do, all the, I'll just for shorthand call it smoke and mirrors, even though that's a little bit
yes.
unfair, because it is a very, it's a very effective offense. It's a very well thought out, well designed offense. It is not really gimmicky in this day and age. Eagles, a lot of zone coverage. They're looking at all this stuff. This would seem to be a tough matchup for the back end of this Eagles defense.
Yeah, and especially linebackers. That's who really gets stressed with Matt Nagy's designs. At the end of rounds, a jet motion. It's interesting because we think of that as Chicago's offense. We think of the RPOs, and that's a big part of what they do. It feels like they do that in bunches, though. They'll do it a bunch on the first series, and then they'll get back to it probably the first series of the second half. But they'll get away from it at times, and when they do, they'll just be a straight execution offense, and it's a lot of dinking and dunking on traditional pass concepts. A lot of these plays with, I think it was fair of you to say smoke and mirrors, because a lot of these passes with all this misdirection, they wind up being pretty basic. They just looked complex before the snap. You've got to be able to be disciplined and not get caught up in the complexity of that if you're an Eagles back seven defender, and they're going to come after you with it. The Bears will really stretch you around down the seams areas near the field numbers, so outside linebackers, strong safeties, those positions have to play with discipline for Philadelphia. And then the X factor that's going to be fascinating, Gary, this Eagles D line looks like the Eagles D line of a year ago. Michael Bennett is absolutely on fire right now, and Chris
yeah.
Long's playing well, and Fletcher Cox is all pro caliber. The Bears have a pretty solid offensive line. It's got Kyle Long back, so it's a more talented line than we've seen in much of this season. I think that battle will decide the game, and if the Eagles can get the Bears off schedule with their D line or not.
Where are we with Mitchell Trubisky at the moment? I feel like the last time we really talked about him in sort of great depth was when they played the Rams on Sunday night. He had a brutal game. The Bears won it anyway on the strength of their defense. Since then, he only has one turnover. He lost a fumble in San Francisco, that ugly lateral scramble type of thing that he did. Also threw a red zone interception that was called back by a penalty in that game, but he has not turned the ball over the last three games. Is he progressing, or are they just scaling back this offense?
Yeah, he hasn't had a chance to turn it over. He's it's dink and dunk underneath, and when he goes downfield, a lot of his passes along the sidelines have wound up out of bounds because of his placement, but also one issue with the Bears receivers, and this will probably get cleaned up if Allen Robinson's back healthy, but it was an issue last week, is some of those guys are running their vertical routes too close to the sideline, so your quarterback doesn't have a window to throw to. So that's part of the reason, by the way, that coaches like throwing the ball outside, is when you miss, it's incomplete versus the risk of being intercepted if you throw it inside. So I think Trubisky, quite frankly, is a complimentary piece in the offense at this point. We've gone a whole season now in Nagy's scheme, and Nagy is not asking a whole lot more of him. If anything, he might even be asking a little less. And that might not be because of Trubisky. Nagy might be realizing, hey, our defense is great. We've got a couple of running backs. We've got a good O-line. We don't need to ask too much of our second-year QB. It could very well be that. Whatever the reason is, though, Mitchell Trubisky is a facilitator in this Bears offense.
That would seem to be good news for an Eagles defense that clearly their weakness is the cornerback play, is the defensive backfield. I mean, to be facing an offense that is not going to be able to burn them downfield would seem to be some nice news for them.
It would. And in fairness to those Eagles, those backups have gotten better as they've gotten more experience, which would be reasonable. Think of it when you come in as a backup midway through a game or you start right away, you haven't been practicing. You're not getting the reps in practice. So not only are these guys now getting reps in games, which is really important, but they're getting practice reps. And Corey Unlin, their secondary coach there in Philadelphia, he ought to be real proud of what they're doing because they've looked better across the board and their back four.
All right. Well, this is of course the game where Andy proclaimed it his best bet, his only bet ever. Eagles.
Oh yeah, I did.
I
don't even remember what I said. What did I say? I like the Eagles in this one. I think we're picking these games this week, Gary.
Do you want to? You never want to pick games, so I don't even ask anymore.
I know, but I did for that upset thing. I'm doing like the upset. Chance of an upset, likelihood of an upset.
Oh, okay.
So I'm already accidental. And I turned in my picks this morning on the MMQB's group Google Doc sheet thing or whatever. It's just a lot of busy work, it feels like.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Fun articles. Fun articles when they come out.
I guess so.
Be sure to click on that. Yeah.
But yes. Click on all the articles and then listen to all the podcasts, please. The spread, for those of you who want to know, it's up to 6 points. Bears are 6-point favorites, so I imagine you're sticking with this as your best bet. I will proclaim that on the gambling podcast on Friday, Andy. I believe you wrote 45% chance of the Eagles winning this game outright.
Yep. Did I say that? Did I say 45?
Well, you wrote it. You wrote it in your upset article.
Yeah. The more I thought about the matchup, the more I've come to like the Eagles.
Even in Chicago, I feel like the Bears are so much better in Chicago, though.
You're right. If forced to pick head-to-head, I'm picking. I guess if I get the Vegas line, I'll pick the Eagles. But if we're doing real-world head-to-head picks, I probably do take Chicago in this game. But I do not think this is an easy matchup for them.
Yeah. All right, let's go to the early Sunday game. This is the Los Angeles Chargers at the Baltimore Ravens, the rematch from Week 16. Let's start with, we talked a ton about the Ravens offense, so let's start with the other side of the ball, although I guess we talked a ton about the Ravens defense too, but specifically when these teams met in Los Angeles in Week 16, Phillip Rivers had a brutal performance. The Ravens defense clearly won that matchup, Eric Weddle and company. And Rivers did not look particularly sharp last week in Denver. Are there issues with this Chargers offense coming into this game?
Well, there's one really glaring issue, and that's their guard position. Dan Feeney has struggled on the left side, and Michael Schofield has struggled even more on the right side. And neither of those guys came into the season as a world beater, but they both survived better than we thought. And then now here we are down the stretch, and they're kind of looking like the guys that had problems in the past. Feeney's only a second-year player. Schofield's been a journeyman, and he's had issues at other positions with other teams before. I don't think Rivers fully trusts those guys in pass protection right now, which is why he's starting to play a little bit, at least in that Baltimore game, played a little bit fast mentally, and we always compliment him on how good he is at getting to his check down, and I still think he's the best I've seen at that, getting through the check down efficiently, and it's hard to deal with a QB that can do that, but there's a fine line between efficiently and way too soon, and there were times that he did it way too soon. So he needs to be a little bit more patient in the Baltimore game. It's easy for me to say, though, in this wild card game, he needs to be more patient. It's easy to say. I'm not the one that has to worry about who's blocking Suggs or Za'Darius Smith or Matt Judon or whoever the Ravens are throwing off the line for me.
No, I mean, that was a huge mismatch when they met in week 16. That interior offensive line just got steamrolled by those Ravens pass rushers.
Well, it's a short lateral movement from Smith that was the biggest problem. So I would imagine if we see Za'Darius Smith line up inside, it will be interesting if the Chargers would slide Mike Pouncey in that way so you can have guys on both sides of Za'Darius Smith, because where he killed Schofield was on left and right movement.
Let's go to the other side here. Ravens offense versus Chargers defense. And, you know, look, sort of consensus is the fact that the Chargers are seeing this unique offense for the second time in 3 weeks. That's a big advantage for them. We did see the Ravens statistically were far more productive in that Browns game in week 17 than they had been in LA. Are we seeing a slightly better offense than what we saw in the Chargers game a couple weeks ago, where they were they were opportunistic? They got the big the long touchdown to Mark Andrews. They also 7 of their 22 points had come on a scoop and score fumble by the defense. So I don't know. I guess I'm looking for a reason to maybe make the argument that maybe the Ravens will be better offensively in this game, but I don't quite see it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like that Andrews touchdown, that was just a blown coverage by Adrian Phillips at linebacker, and he's had an excellent season, and he had actually defended that route a few times earlier in the game, and for whatever reason, he bombed it on that play. I don't think you can count on that kind of thing, but you have to. They're going to have to manufacture. Well, here, let's ask this, Gary. If you're the Ravens, and you know the Chargers have seen your unique rushing attack once already, and you haven't faced a defense that's seen it, that doesn't mean you can't run the ball still. I mean, you might still get 200 yards, and you're confident in your rushing attack. How confident are you, though? Do you feel coming into this game that you're going to need, let's say, two or three explosive pass plays in order to compete, or do you think you can win the way you did last time, where you did get the one big play, but other than that, it was just you won on totally the strength of your defense?
I think you need three in your pocket. You need three plays you can pull out here. I can't remember the specifics, and I apologize for that. The Mark Andrews touchdown, they said they saw something where they knew they could draw Adrian Phillips in on that play and open that route up for Andrews. So if you can build three of those, you know, three shots you can take during the game, and you get one or two, that might be enough. Because you also figure, look, you're in your building this time. Whether you know how much stock you put into body clock type stuff. This is an early game for a West Coast team, so
yeah. I don't love that they did that, by the way. I don't love that the Chargers have to play the 10, especially. And I get, look, Chargers are the road team. There's home field advantage. That's part of it. Chargers are 12-4, though. It's not like this is a team that fell on its face and got in the wild card. They're 12-4. They're the second-best record in the AFC, basically. Ravens are 10-6. I wish they would have made this the Saturday game so that it would be a little less disadvantageous to the Chargers.
Yeah. Now, I've had a lot of problems with with the schedule this year, which I think I've mentioned on the show and written about. I think they've... I mean, look, maybe the feedback from teams was that they, you know, teams think they have a good enough grasp on this stuff that they can deal with the travel and the time changes and that sort of thing.
I'd be surprised. I don't think I haven't heard any team be that open-minded about it.
Yeah.
They are when they have to be, but when they can request anything, they don't think that way.
Yep. It seemed like there were a lot of these type of weird scheduling games with teams zigzagging across the country and teams traveling two time zones for Thursday night. And I mean, the Bears played Sunday night, and then they played the early game on Thanksgiving, which was insane.
Oh, yeah, that was the worst. What the other thing I don't understand on this tangent about scheduling and playoffs is why they go Saturday and then Sunday and eschew the Sunday night and Monday night slots. There are four games, and there are four regular broadcast windows already built into a typical NFL weekend. 1 o'clock Sunday, 4:30 Sunday, 8 o'clock Sunday, or whenever Sunday night football starts, and then 8:30 on Monday. I'm a little surprised that they don't play the games that way rather than two on Saturday, two on Sunday. And they've got their reasons. I forget what the reasons were, but they'd make more money at their playoff broadcast if they put them on. They don't play this in prime time, these playoff games.
I don't know why they don't do Sunday night. They should have one of these games 4:25 Sunday and the other one at 8:20 or whenever the Sunday night game officially kicks off. Monday night, I understand you don't want to take a day away from the winning team and
but you already do that with Saturday. You already do Saturday. It's a matter of whether you take the day away on the front end or the back end. And what they could also do to make the number one seed more valuable is the number one seed gets to play the Monday team. That would make one of the number one seeds more valuable. So, like, whichever team's the home team in the Super Bowl that year, I think this year it's the AFC's the home team, technically, then make the number one AFC seed the team that gets to play the Monday team. I don't know if I guess you can't control it, though, huh?
Because you reseed.
Reseeding, yeah.
So you could have the 4-5 game and assume that the 3 is probably going to beat the 6. But
yeah, that's a big assumption. Well, so, and now we've learned that it's easier to criticize than to actually come up with the ideas ourselves.
Well, that's why we have this podcast, and we don't do anything of actual substance about this stuff. But yeah, this Ravens team, I mean, I think that's the strategy offensively. You do what you've been doing, and you want to control the clock for 35, 40 minutes, but you got to get one or two big ones here.
And they have to be manufactured off of your running game, like that Mark Andrews play. The play was an over route, which I'm sure had a play. I forget as well, but I almost guarantee it had a play action is what brought Phillips up, and Andrews ran behind him. It's got to be something like that because you're going to keep playing the way you do play because you have to play that way because Lamar Jackson's a limited passer at this point in his career.
All right, well, let's go back to Saturday night, the Saturday night game. This is Seahawks at Cowboys. Let's start with the Dallas offense versus the Seattle defense. I don't know, Andy. Amari Cooper cooled down a little bit the last couple of weeks. This Seahawks defense, their susceptibility is, the cornerback play. They're not great. Of course, the Cowboys don't have great weapons. You have Cooper and you have some dudes. What, I mean, for the Cowboys, I guess you're just sticking with the old grind it out with Ezekiel Elliott and work the pass game off of that?
Probably. I mean, in the most basic sense, yes. You do know a little bit what you'll get with Seattle because they have some coverage foundations. I do think Cooper has to be a big deal in this game. He can't just be a decoy. It's hard to be what's interesting is the Seahawks really don't tweak their coverages a whole lot to account for your best guys. They don't, like against Kansas City a few weeks ago, they just lined up and played. They played straight man coverage. They played some of their cover three zone. They have an identity and it's built around simplicity, and we're going to play faster because we're simple. That's how they think. And I think that's a pretty good approach against Dak Prescott, who's not a fast quarterback. He's a fast mover. He can run well, but the way he plays the position, he's not a fast decision maker, and he's not a fastball thrower. He's not a twitchy release kind of thrower. I want to make Dak Prescott have to beat me through the air if I'm Seattle.
Well, can they, with what the Seahawks have up front, I mean, can you kind of, what do you think this front seven, the Seahawks front seven versus what this Cowboys offensive line became this year?
Seahawks front seven's better than people realize. It's not just Frank Clark and it's not just Bobby Wagner. They've got some younger, and Quentin Jefferson's been okay at times within the context of the scheme. The guy I really like, is the rookie. What Puna, I think is how you say it. Number 97.
Puna Ford.
Puna Ford. I keep calling him Puna because that just feels like more of a last name to me than a first name. But he is a really good player. He's been getting a bigger role each week for them. Jaron Reed, I'm a big fan of, have been for a while. It's these guys all play. This is what happens when you're a simple scheme, is your young guys play well within the context of the scheme because they got very defined rules and responsibilities, and so they play faster and they play better as the season's progressed, and we've seen that with some of these young defensive front seven players in Seattle.
Yeah, Puna Ford. Always.
Yeah, Puna Ford.
He always stuck out to me because doing all the draft stuff last year and sort of building my spreadsheet, and you sort of get in that rhythm of because we just run the stupid like heights and weights as you go on. So as I'm writing the scouting reports, you just punch in, and when you get to the defensive lineman, you just have
it.
Everything 6-something, and you get to him, and it was 5'11". It was weird. It was weird to see
5'11". 309, and he's a very good lateral mover, and I'd love to see his. We talked about Duvernay Tardif's name on the jersey. I'd love to see his full name on the jersey someday, because I bet you everybody who knows him calls him Puna. I bet you know how they call, like, everyone calls me Benoit at the MMQB. Nobody,
yes.
I don't think even half the staff knows my first name. I bet you they never call him Ford. Like when they're they're Clinton Hurt, their D line coach, who's a good one by the way in Seattle. I bet he never yells out, "Hey Ford." I bet he always yells, "Hey Puna." Out there, and it just depends on the guy and the name.
Let's go Seahawks offense versus Cowboys defense here. Seahawks, the most run heavy team in the NFL this year, and obviously they work a lot of good things in the passing game off of that, but yeah, I don't know. Sean Lee is rotating back in with these linebackers. Cowboys up front have been good all year. So that Marinelli sort of slanting, stunting front, how does that work against what the Seahawks do now, where they've gotten away from that outside zone scheme, and it's more inside stuff, more gap stuff?
Yeah, and Dallas needs to be on high alert for that, because against Arizona last week, Seattle, for whatever reason, they felt it would be good to go back to the outside zone scheme, and the Cardinals absolutely destroyed them. They had the Seahawks had one long run from Chris Carson on a poor run fit by Hassan Reddick, and that was in, actually came on the play after Reddick cost the Cardinals a sack fumble touchdown with an illegal contact. So a bad two-play sequence for the young Cardinal linebacker, and if not for that sequence, Seattle probably loses that game, because their front seven in Arizona dominated Seattle's offensive line and running game on the outside zone stuff. Dallas has an even better front seven than the Cardinals. Having Lee back in the equation is a big deal too, because Seattle runs out of base personnel so much that you often have three linebackers on the field. I don't know how much he'll play. Damian Wilson's been fine as another linebacker for the Cowboys, but those Cowboy linebackers versus Seattle run game and Russell Wilson and the mobility threat, yeah, that's where this one comes down to. And part B is when Seattle does take shots downfield, I would imagine they'll attack those linebackers, much like how the Ravens attacked Adrian Phillips on that over route off of play action. And Dallas has been very good across the board at defending those routes this year.
Do you remember the game these teams played last? I think it was right before Christmas last year, last December.
Oh, give me a clue. Say one or two things that jogs my memory on it.
It was, well.
Oh, yes, I do. Russell Wilson took a sack or had a horrible throw left on the field early in the game, I remember. I think it was in Dallas, and the game went like that for the rest of the day, and the Seahawks, if I recall, had like zero passing yards.
They did, and they won 21-12 based on it was just a ridiculous game. The Seahawks had 142 penalty yards and 136 yards of offense, and they won the game, which was
crazy.
I think I looked it up, and it was like the second time in NFL history that it ever happened where the team that had more penalty yards than offensive yards won.
I mean, how many times has that even happened, period? That's hard to get more penalty yards than total yards.
It really is.
These are such different teams. You know, they played back in week 3, and since then, Seattle, when they entered that week three game, they had been a pass-first offense, and they got sacked a whole bunch in the first 2 weeks and said, okay, now we're going to run the ball. And they changed their identity. And then Dallas, since that week three, obviously they've had the Amari Cooper trade, and Leighton Vander Esch has come on, and their defense is better. It's a young defense that's gotten better. These are two ascending teams. Very different than when they played in week three. It'd be interesting to know how much they're studying that week three film, because I guarantee it's not as much as the Chargers and Ravens are studying their week 16 film.
All right, let's go to the first game.
We forgot to pick these. We forgot to pick these.
Oh, we did forget to pick these.
I want to pick both sides again.
Let's go back to Baltimore and the Chargers. That line is still at the moment holding steady at 2.5 for Baltimore.
I'm taking the Chargers. I don't think Rivers will get stymied 2 out of 3 weeks like that by the same defense.
Yeah, I mean, it's just...
And if they score early, and if Ravens are in a hole, Ravens have to play with a lead. I'm taking the Chargers.
It's weird.
Even at the 10 o'clock.
Because
yeah.
I almost feel like, and obviously, you know, had the Ravens lost that game on Saturday night, two Saturday nights ago to the Chargers, they probably wouldn't be in the playoffs. But I almost feel like I'd feel better about the Ravens had they lost the first time these teams played, or had they played at a point in the season, obviously, before Lamar Jackson was in there. So I like the Chargers in that one, too. This Seahawks-Cowboys line has moved down to 1.5 at most of the books. So basically, Vegas lines are suggesting the Seahawks are the better team, but Dallas still has a slight edge because of the home field.
I like Dallas in the matchup. I think Dallas is the more complete team. I think Dallas is the better team.
Yeah,
They're very similar in how they play. Yeah.
Yep. That line's a weird line to me. I thought Dallas would be given like 3.5 at this point, but I guess not. Colts Texans round 3, obviously these teams split. The road team won each of the first two times. They played something of a shootout early in the season. That was that overtime game where Frank Reich went for it, and you know, stuff happened, and the Texans end up kicking a field goal as time expired. But when these teams met a couple of weeks ago in Houston, the Colts dominated that one pretty good. On top of that, the Texans are now without Demaryius Thomas, so you know you have DeAndre Hopkins, and you don't have a whole lot else going on that offense. You know, Texans are still moving the ball a little bit without Thomas. I mean, how are they doing this? Because it's Deshaun Watson is going to run around and make some plays late in the down, or he's going to throw it to DeAndre Hopkins. I don't know what other options they really have. It's a pretty pedestrian run game.
Yeah, it is. The Colts defense now, it's not set up to double Hopkins naturally. The Colts have their scheme. They play what they play. If they do want to double Hopkins, they'll go to man-to-man and probably play man-robber. So they'll have two safeties start out in the middle of the field, and then one of them will drop down into the shallow middle of the field, and he'll probably drop down to near wherever Hopkins is aligned. But that's still not a whole lot within Indy's repertoire. It's a pretty zone-based defense. Even when they've blitzed, which has been more in the second half of the season than first half, they've often played at least zone structures behind the blitz. I think this comes down, Gary, you're right, the Texans do not have a lot of weapons. And you've got to make Deshaun Watson feel that. You've got to make him play uncomfortably. I want him running around if I'm the Colts. We need to be prepared and disciplined for that. I'm going to be holding my breath while he does it. But you want to get Watson playing off schedule, because the whole Texans offense does not operate super smoothly when he does. And that was the biggest difference in that game last time when the Colts beat him, is Watson was unsettled in the pocket and he broke himself down and played off schedule by choice too often. He got hot for a little bit there late, but he was really the reason Houston lost the game, quite frankly. You got to get Watson playing that way.
Other side of the ball here. When the Colts beat them in Houston, they threw it all over the place. And look, that's how teams have been attacking this Texans defense all year. They're just not very good at the cornerback spots on the back end. Is there any reason to think that the Colts can't just do this all over again?
Well, J.J. Watt would be a reason, and Jadeveon Clowney would be a reason. But that's, you know, they were factors last time as well, and Indianapolis' mm-hmm. offensive line's gotten better. We know that. Look, it was interesting because the Colts tried to smash mouth this thing in the last matchup. They went three. How many teams have won games where they've gone three and out on their first four series, which is what Indianapolis did in that last Houston game? And then on the fifth series, they came out and they threw deep to T.Y. Hilton. It was a 60-yarder. I think it came out of a run personnel heavy look again. And after that, they spread out and threw the ball and found their rhythm and won the game. So it's the Colts can – they're really an amoeba offense the more you look at them. They can do a lot of different things. They've been playing with Joe Haig, a sixth offensive lineman at times, trying to have a smash-mouth foundational ground game. Remember, Frank Reich was there in Philly last year where we complimented the Eagles for how expansive their running game was. And now without Reich there, they, for whatever reason, maybe that's the reason, they've been less expansive in their run game in Philadelphia. Well, the Colts are starting to take on some of that Eagle look, and they've got the linemen to do it. So I don't know if I would say it's all pass game and just gouge the Texans and make their DBs have to survive. Maybe that's a plan, but it's I wouldn't be surprised if the Colts are a little more balanced in this game.
Well, they kept throwing even with the lead that last time that they met.
I do
remember that game. They had it was Eric Ebron had a terrible third down drop at the beginning, I think, off the first drive, and they had another really bad drop by, I think, Mo Alie-Cox on another third down play that should have been a conversion, and then they had another another luck interception that had bounced off a receiver's hand. So I actually thought the Colts played a somewhat sloppy game when they went to Houston and won by, you know, the final was 24-21, but that's a game they led by 10 for the majority of the second half.
You make a great point there because you're right. At the end of that game, they leaned on their passing game. They did not go back to their running game, which maybe that does lead you to believe we're going to see them come out. One thing they do like to do is early in drives, on their first play, second play of the drive, often on the first two plays, they'll go out into spread empty and then just do a quick strike passing game. And they don't stay in it all day, but that's how they get the drives going. Maybe the more I think about this, yeah, you might be right. Less balance, more quick strike, and substitute the run game for fast passes. Because the other thing when you do that is Clowney and Watt, now you don't really have to block those guys.
They're also, I mean, they're good on those quick screens too. I'd throw it 40 times if I were Frank Reich.
You would?
Well, I'd have my quarterback throw it 40 times, to be more specific.
Reich can still throw too, I bet. Remember, Frank Reich's had some passes in playoff games before.
He has. He's got a really nice beard.
And actually, against Houston.
That's
different,
right?
Houston. But yeah.
He has, by the way, he has a polarizing beard in our office.
I agree. He never in a million years would have grown that before getting a head coaching job. He looks like he's 85 years old, and I think it's too much beard. I don't think it fits. A guy with that kind of a jaw, a square, like I wear a beard, and it's partly to give the illusion of a firm jaw, if I'm being totally vulnerable and exposed and honest about it.
Yeah.
Frank Reich doesn't have that issue. He's still built like a pro, 6'5 pocket passing quarterback. He shouldn't have to wear a beard.
I really like the beard. I think I'm the beard's biggest fan. And I like that it's just a little bit scraggly.
You've got the biggest neck beard. You're a neck beard guy. I've seen you.
I'm just an unshaven guy. I'm a lazy
guy. Yeah, that's
what I am. I've given up on my physical appearance. But I'm on the bandwagon. It might not be a bandwagon. It might only be me. I'm trying to gather people to join my bandwagon for the Frank Reich beard. I think it's a good-looking beard.
Is it something they're all doing? Like Chris Ballard, their GM, also has a beard. That's another guy with a really firm jaw that probably doesn't need to be wearing a beard. And he has – his is really gray, and his hair is not gray. And I don't think he's dyeing his hair. Why are they all growing beards there in Indy?
Vinatieri
still has a beard.
Vinatieri looks
–
he has brown hair, but then his beard looks like he dyed his beard. Maybe they are dyeing their beards. I don't know.
Or just dipped it in baking powder or something. I mean, his is really white. Andrew Luck always grows a beard as the season goes on because I guess the chin strap gives him rashes. But even then, that's no excuse for the way he's let his beard go sometimes. His will go in any direction. His face loses all shape because the beard's not tamed. He's a little bit like your beards would, I imagine, grow, Gary, if you didn't have a wife, if someone weren't there to tell you, okay, at least get the trimmers out.
I also haven't had a haircut since August.
Is that
I'm
true?
A mess here. And I sent you what I'm wearing today for the podcast.
Yeah, you did. I saw it was weird. You sent a picture of your Nathan Peterman t-shirt, which the t-shirt says Nate Peterman, which kind of bugs me.
Yeah, it bugged me too.
On the last topic of this, you also sent me your Christmas card. Thank you for that. I was wondering where it was. I wasn't going to say anything, but I figured the only way you wouldn't send it is if you had to deliberately take me off your list, because I just started receiving them like 2 years ago, and it's too quick to be off the Christmas card. Everyone just recycles last year's list until they don't know someone a decade later. Then they remove them. Here's my question for you. How long do you have to wait before you can dispose of a Christmas card? Because they're very, and yours was wonderful. I love seeing Liz and your kids. They're all cluttery, though. I mean, you get them in bunches, yeah. Christmas cards everywhere, they're cluttery. So at some point, you have to throw them away. And when you do, you see the faces of your loved ones looking back up at you from the trash.
From the trash can.
It's just a horror. Yeah, it feels. Well, yeah, yeah. Trash is easier, but yeah. So how long do you have to wait before you can dispose of a Christmas card? And is there an appropriate way to do it?
We take ours down. Liz will go down and we display them all. And she'll start taking them down the night of New Year's. So like January 1st. So today we have no more Christmas cards up in the house.
What you said, start taking them. That almost implies this is a multi-day process.
That part probably all happens in one day. But deconstructing the entire holiday scene in the, you know, in the living room and the dining room and stuff, that's a multi-day. And I don't contribute at all, which is what makes it a multi-day process for my wife.
Yeah, we've got 8 tubs in the Benoit household of stuff.
Yeah.
Big, full-size tubs. Love
it. That's actually why I signed in slightly late today. She has to move the couch that I podcast from and to get into the storage space for our Christmas stuff, so... It's in a great way to wrap Colts Texans here.
We haven't picked the game yet. That's embarrassing.
Colts Texans. I'm picking point
Colts.
Point and a half.
Point and a half. Colts for me.
I'm picking Colts too. That was pretty lame. We had the 4 same picks. So if you want to skip the games this weekend, the Colts, the Cowboys, the Chargers, and the Eagles. I guess we kind of disagreed on the Eagles. I think the Bears are going to win outright. I think Eagles will cover a 6-point spread. But, there you go. Let's talk coaches real quick and then get to a couple mailbag questions. So obviously we talked about a lot of the coaches who had been dismissed or we anticipated would be dismissed when we did the Monday podcast, which we tape very early on Monday morning. Since then, 2 names that we didn't expect. Not that we're shocked by him, but we didn't expect. Adam Gase is out, and Marvin Lewis is out. Let's start with Gase. My understanding, and this is from, you know, whatever, 1,000 miles away, literally from Miami, my understanding is that there was some friction with players, and there were, it seemed like it was getting a little bit ugly in the locker room there.
That would not surprise me. Gase has a hard edge to him, and I'm sure not everybody enjoys being around that on a daily basis. And he's probably someone, even though he's a young coach, he might be a guy that needs a veteran team. He was great with Peyton Manning because you're not going to, the hard edge isn't going to have to come into play a whole lot, because when guys know what they're doing and the quarterback's got a voice, and I'm not saying Tannehill did not, I'm sure he did. Gase is pretty helpful and lenient. He understands how hard his life is on his quarterback, and he tries to accommodate that. So it's probably other people besides the QB. But yeah, I could see where Gase has a specific personality. And he came up under Mike Martz initially. So you've got to, you've got to have the right team for him. I'm trying to think if Aaron Rodgers and the Packers fit there.
I can't remember if I said it on the show, because I thought it as soon as McCarthy was out, if they could get Adam Gase there. I didn't think Gase would be out in Miami. So I don't know if I ever made that public statement, but I do think Gase would be outstanding, for the Packers. I think he'd be as good a fit as they can get.
And see, I don't think he'd appreciate the way Rodgers plays. I think he'd have a real problem with that.
Yeah.
I don't know what he would do about it. I mean, he wouldn't disparage Aaron Rodgers. But if I were Gase, I think I'd rather, and some of that's lifestyle choice too, what I'm about to say here, but I think I'd rather coach the Cardinals and live in Phoenix or live, I don't know what they're from. His kids were from Denver, but they've been in Miami. I don't know if that matters at all, Wisconsin versus Phoenix, Arizona area for him, but I would rather, I'm not going to say I'd rather have Josh Rosen than Rodgers because that's ridiculous. But stylistically, Rosen's more congruent with a Gase offense than Rodgers is.
See, I was just thinking, if Gase is so good at sort of helping his quarterbacks with pre-snap reads and that sort of thing, does that almost offset what seemed to be kind of issues for Rodgers early in the down? That we speculate that he maybe doesn't read defense as well before the snap or early in the down, and that's why he prefers to play the style that he plays. So maybe bringing Gase can offset that a little bit.
Well, from what I've heard about Rodgers, he does read the defense fine early in the down, but he takes into consideration a lot of little things that can go wrong. He's a very smart guy, and he's a very details guy. Elephant memory, I've heard that, and so he'll remember, hey, so-and-so, once we played the Ravens in Week 12 back in 2013, and Suggs dropped into the passing lane there, so I was worried that this guy might drop into that same passing lane because it's the same look. I mean, I heard it's that kind of deal sometimes with Rodgers, which you wonder how anybody could do anything if that's how they think. So it's almost like a mad genius if that's true. Again, I've never been around Aaron Rodgers. But let's assume he can read defenses, because what's so befuddling is right when you think he's just a runaround random player, he'll flip a switch and be on schedule and totally with discipline. So I don't know what to make of Rodgers, and I bet you Gase wouldn't like that, though, with not knowing what to make of your QB. Because look at where Gase had his best years. It was with Peyton Manning. Peyton Manning is the antithesis of Aaron Rodgers in this sense, and not knowing what you'll get. You always know what you'll get with Peyton Manning if you're a coach.
My last two thoughts here on Gase. Number one, I think the Dolphins are going to be terrible next year. Number two, I think he'd really... I mean, based on all the reporting we did last draft season on Baker Mayfield, I am 98% confident that Adam Gase wanted Baker Mayfield very, very much. If Cleveland's going to move on, Gase is an option for them. The weird part with that would be, and not that you base your coach hiring on Jarvis Landry, but the Browns have made something of a commitment to Jarvis Landry, and it seems that Jarvis Landry and Adam Gase do not send each other Christmas cards.
Yeah, correct. They do, or at least theirs go right to the trash, and they don't have to think about it. That's a good point. And is that a big enough deal to deter coach? And that's a weird one, because Landry's only—he's a mere wide receiver, but he's your best receiver, and yeah, it's a big financial commitment to him. And I don't know. The personality things was so interesting, because Mayfield, he's got to have your respect, or you got to have his, or whatever it is. And Josh Rosen's the same way. And Rodgers, these are all kind of difficult, genius personality quarterbacks here with these head coaching jobs available. Rosen, Baker Mayfield, and Aaron Rodgers, from what it appears from afar.
I'm still shocked that he's out. Marvin Lewis, I'm shocked that he's out, because I just thought my children and my children's children would be watching Marvin Lewis coach the Cincinnati Bengals. So a change in the guard there, though. I don't know how big a change it's going to be. Now, listen, we tape on Wednesday evening, so maybe news will come down the pipe in the meantime. But Vance Joseph, Hugh Jackson have been mentioned as potential replacements here for Marvin Lewis, which at that point, I still think Vance Joseph is going to be a good coach someday. But if Hugh Jackson really is a candidate here, why did you fire Marvin Lewis? Like, you might as well just keep him.
Yeah, I don't know how to pick the Bengals. I do know, I've heard Mike Brown, their owner, is a really smart football guy. Like, he can, like, he's like a coach. Like, he knows the game at that level. I've heard that. And what's also very obvious is that he likes familiarity.
Yeah. He does. We'll see. We'll see how that goes. One mailbag question here, Andy.
Okay.
Let's see. Let's go with we got a couple Steelers questions. This stuff is still playing out there, so we'll hold off on that. But let's go. Nick has a question here about Todd Gurley, and obviously we've talked about Gurley and the MVP candidacy and all that stuff a lot over the last 2 years. Nick asks, with Todd Gurley sitting out the last 2 weeks of the season, and we now are able to assess Andy's argument that losing Gurley doesn't force the Rams to change their scheme, and Sean McVay's counter-argument that they do a lot more of what highlights Gurley's skills. We saw C.J. Anderson have the two big games, Andy. What do you make of it as far as what the Rams, I don't know, I guess are without Todd Gurley and what exactly Gurley's quote-unquote value is to this offense?
I think both arguments gained strength with the C.J. Anderson's last couple games. My argument that, yeah, Gurley, you can replace him with someone else and still run the system, we saw that with Anderson. And McVay's argument is, yeah, there are certain things, though, that you call more with Gurley in there. He's mainly talking, I'm guessing he's talking about their backfield screen game, among other things.
Yep.
And we have not seen that with Anderson as much. So I think everybody's still in position on that one. And Todd Gurley is a great player, and they'll take him over C.J. Anderson any day of the week. And the Rams, a lot of what comes down to it for the Rams is their offensive line. And it's how Jared Goff plays. It's how Gurley plays. They're built on that offensive line. And when it plays well, the Rams hum. And when it doesn't play well, the Rams do what they did against the Eagles and Bears.
Yeah. All right. That's a wrap then. We'll get more mailbag questions in next week. We will have the usual Monday morning show. We'll be back to recap the wild card games. We will do our postmortems for the teams that lose on wild card weekend, and we'll obviously talk a little bit about the winners and as well. But that's going to do it for now. Thanks to our researchers, Reed Foster and Ryan Taylor, who make it sound smart. Thank you, as always, to producer Shelby Royston and the guys at K13 who make it sound good. Most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast. You are the best. Keep those questions coming. We'll try to fit in two or three in, on the divisional round show next Thursday. As for the rest of the MMQB podcast series, I'll be back on Friday with Jimmy Traina and Scott Gramling for the MMQB gambling show. If you go back in your feed one, you'll get Jenny Brentis. I think Bet Marston sat in for Connor Orr this week. They joined Albert Breer to break down the biggest news, lots of coaching stuff from around the league. We ask that you subscribe to the MMQB Podcast Network wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Radio.com/10things, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys Monday morning.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team. Every day.